Welcome to the Psych Podcast. I am once again joined by Paul Bloom. Paul, how are you doing?
I am terrific. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing very well because it's been a while since I have completely doubted whether external reality exists until I read this chapter.
I'm glad to have prompted such interesting doubts, but I hope you didn't stay with the dark side and become a skeptic.
I did not. So today we are talking about sensation, perception, and memory. And I guess I would say that these are all the processes by which we use information to guide our behavior in the world, in our judgment, something like that.
That's one way of looking at it. It could be also sort of thought of as the story of how the world gets in the head. You know, we're these brains trapped in skulls, and somehow we come to appreciate the world, and we sense it, and then we perceive it, and then we store it in memory, and then you know, we could extract it again when we remember things.
Sometimes,
yes.
There are so many parts of psychology that clearly intersect with philosophy, but this is one of the big ones, right? This is the question of how we come to know anything about the world around us, if we do. And if so, how? And I think it's fairly uncontroversial to say that vast swaths of the universe around us are completely inaccessible to our minds. But there is a sliver. There's a sliver of stuff that we seem to have access to. And that's what our brain is doing when it's picking up, you know, vibrations in the air, or light waves, or particles in our nose. And I've always been fascinated by that we only have, you know, like a slim little bit of information. For instance, most of the spectrum of energy, we have absolutely no access to it. It's humbling.
It's humbling. You look at other creatures and dogs and bees, and they have an entirely different spectrum. And in some way, you know, the olfactory, the smelling world of a dog is incomparably more vast than ours. You look at a color spectrum and you find that we just, it's a tiny, like you say, a sliver of it. And then some people get all skeptical here and they say, well, that means we can't know anything. That means we don't know about the world at all. But I think what we should marvel at is kind of the opposite, that from this sliver, we extract representations of the world. And somehow, along with sort of the methods of science and logic and rationality, we managed to come from this tiny bit and bootstrap our way up. So you and I could say, wow, there's all these patterns of light and smell that we can't be sensitive, that we aren't sensitive to, but we know they exist. We have perceptual systems evolved for the sort of middle-sized objects of people and rocks and trees and tigers. But we could somehow got into this where we can talk about and understand atoms and molecules and galaxies, the very small and the very big. And this is astonishing.
At some point, I think every child who's interested in science has space photos on their computer or on their wall. And I remember the cruel realization that the colors that I was seeing wasn't actually what the space looked like.
Oh, yeah. I was this years old. I discovered fairly recently that wasn't what they looked like.
But it's electromagnetic energy that we need special equipment. But you're right that we could bootstrap our way from our limited access to the world around us to gain knowledge. But that's what it's all about, right? This is in some ways just epistemology. It's the question of how we know what we know.
That's right. That's right. And also you start to wonder the question of, you know, you're looking at a tree and you're thinking about the tree. What's the relationship between your tree thoughts and that tree out there? And that's one of the great problems of philosophy. How does the mind represent things? You know, and then, you know, I'm going to be talking to you later today. So in the morning, I'm thinking about you. How is there something in my head that somehow connects to you? What makes it a representation of you? And I don't get into this in my book, but these philosophical questions, like you say, are always sort of adjacent to the psychological ones.
You use the words sensation and perception, and I use those words, and psych textbooks use the words. It's not as if there's this natural, beautiful break between sensation and perception, but the words, as I understand them, are meant to be Well, you have the raw process that's going on. The light is hitting your retina and entering your brain as electrochemical information. The sound waves are making your little hair cells bounce up and down. It's that first step that we're referring to when we say sensation, right? Before the rest of the brain gets involved in making sense, oddly, making sense.
Yeah,
that's of right. It. Yeah.
That's right. And then most of our conscious experience is the sort of post-processing things. So when I look at my son's faces, I don't see lines and colors and patterns on the red. I see faces. I see faces of people I love. When we're talking, I don't hear the sound pattern. I don't consciously perceive the sound patterns. I hear your voice, somebody I know well. I know what you're saying. I know what it means. So you can wonder how he studies sensation at all.
And yeah.
We talk about cases where our experience is relatively unprocessed. And we could talk about that in terms of sensation. So the philosopher Jerry Fodor, who thought a lot about this, has a nice example, which is, as me, an English speaker, when I hear English, I can't hear the sounds. I just hear English. I hear gaps between the words, even though none exist. But if I hear Swedish, I kind of know what Swedish sounds like. I don't have any perceptual mechanisms.
right.
And there's some very simple experiments that try to look at sensation shorn of perception. Like there's all of these lovely studies on comparison where you have two lights, one's dim and one's bright, and what's the difference between them up until the point you can't tell the difference anymore, or you're holding something in one hand and holding something in the other. And so the study of psychophysics looks at a lot of that.
And you know, there's a technology angle there. There's a lot of stuff that's in the auditory information that hits our ears that we just don't process. And you can actually get rid of that. And when you get rid of that, you can make your audio files smaller. So the things that we're recording right now, if we were to record all of the information that we're getting, the wide range of frequencies, the files would be too big and it would take up a lot of space on your phone. But people who worked in psychophysics and people who study perception figured out, you know, you could remove large chunks of this and it still sounds fine. So we've actually made technological strides from,
yeah, that's right,
from understanding this stuff.
That's right. And people who work in technologies like photography, I have to think deeply about the chasm between our perception, our sensation of the world, and how we perceive it. And one thing you point out is we kind of fill in gaps. And people like you who are really sophisticated in sort of auditory and just, you know, podcast creation and everything, are really good at exploiting these psychological tendencies. You could take away stuff and our mind will fill it in. One of the sort of classic old school psychology experiments is you take a sentence somebody is saying and you take away a part and replace it with a cough.
Yeah.
And people don't hear sentence, word, break with a cough and then going on. What they fill in what was missing and they don't even know they do it. Also, another classic example is you can, one reason why proofreading is hard is because our minds automatically correct them. It's very easy. You send somebody an email with the word "the" repeated. And so often they just won't notice it. Because they've
right,
just,
two,
just fixed
two
it.
Does in a row, especially as you point, as you use in your book, when there's a "the" at the end of a line and a "the" at the beginning of a
line.
That's right. Forget it. There is an old proofreading trick where people read backwards. They read the sentence backwards.
I have never cared about anything in my life well enough to do that.
There is a cottage industry of people who create visual illusions. In fact, there's a contest every year to see who comes up with the coolest visual illusion. Oftentimes, these very nicely show the difference between sensation and perception. The easiest way that I explain this difference to my students is I say, look at the door in the corner. You see a rectangle. You really see a rectangle, but the door happens to be open just a little bit. So the image that's hitting your eye isn't a true rectangle. You just cannot help but see a rectangle. That is because your perceptual faculties, whatever those are, that the computation, the manipulation of information that's hitting your eyes is presenting to your conscious experience a rectangular normal door. Same as an example that you use in your book. When you walk away from me, I don't think, gee, Paul is shrinking. Oh my God. So our brain is, as they say, fixing it in post.
Yeah. Oh, nicely put. Yeah. So, and you know, some people say, oh, illusions, they show the flaws of our visual system, but it's exactly the opposite. Our visual system just fills in stuff, makes corrections, automatically compensates. And illusions exist when very clever psychologists, and before that artists, would create things that in the real world would go one way, but they set it up cleverly so it goes in a different way. So one of the simplest illusions is the Mueller-Royer illusion, which involves two horizontal lines, one above the other. And you just have stuff at the end of the lines that makes you see one of the lines as something receding into the distance, the other one approaching you. So you perceive the lines as different sizes, even though if you take a ruler, you see that they are the same size.
And those are illusions, as people have pointed out, that no matter what you know, you absolutely, after you've measured it, know that one line is longer than the other. They nonetheless appear different lengths.
And that connects to a huge debate in psychology, which concerns the extent to which your beliefs and desires about the world, your assumptions, affect how you perceive the world. So there's all sorts of ways which they have to. That's what we're talking about. But there seems to be some ways in which they don't. And that's really important for some great philosophical debates. So the story for the standard illusions is, even once you know they're illusions, they don't go away. And that seems to suggest that there's some systems in your mind that are modular, and that's sort of a psychologist term of art. And one of the things modular means is they work no matter what you think about them.
Another way of putting it is that they are protected from your cognition. And here, yeah, cognition means higher order cognition, your judgments, your beliefs.
That's right. And some big things might be at stake on this. You know, yeah, it depends on how we could think about disagreement. Suppose you and I are looking at something in a distance and you say, man, that's really large. And I say, no, it's not as big as you think it is. And if it really did turn out that our beliefs as to what things really are affects how we see it, it's difficult to see how disagreements could be resolved. Suppose in an extreme case, you know, there are three people in the distance. You think there are three. I think there are two. We're both staring. And because of how the mind works, you see it as three and I see it as two. We're just kind of stuck. But the mind probably doesn't work that way. Often our mind does fills in expectations, resolves inconsistencies. We see what we expect to see, but it's limited. The last thing I expect to see as I'm talking to you is a gorilla walking across the room with a knife ready to stab me. But if there was one, I would see it.
Right.
And that's really cool. And in fact, as Jerry Fodor points out, that's kind of what perception is for, to tell you stuff you don't know.
You point out that there are other kinds of information that do work their way in, other kinds of expectations that do. And some of that is contextual. So the classic visual illusion where you have a painting of a tiled floor, there's a checkered board pattern, white and black tiles. But you point out that for two of those tiles, even though one appears to be clearly white and the other, yeah, one appears to be clearly black, they actually are the same exact color, in the sense that the same exact wavelength of light is hitting your eye. But we can't help but see one as white and one as black. Why? Because the lighting conditions that are presented to you in the painting itself are mimicking sort of this contextual information that you would have in the real world. So your expectations, I guess, of how the world works, how light works, how things cast shadows, are working their way into some of your perceptions.
That's right. And so how do you reconcile that? By the way, the illusion you're talking about was made by the vision scientist Edward Adelson. And if you Google his name, you'll just see it, the illusion, right away. One way to reconcile this is the visual system itself has built-in expectations about shadows, about distance, about how things work. And it just automatically corrects. And that kind of correction happens all the time. But what doesn't get into the visual system is sort of higher order things like, oh my God, I measured that with a ruler and it was the same size. Or I read in a book that that's an illusion. That sort of thing doesn't permeate. So it's not really top down. It's all part of a visual system that constantly makes its own expectations. But our own thoughts don't play a role.
Right. So it might be pulling information, environmental contextual information, might be pulling different sorts of information.
That's right.
To use. It's not as if the visual system doesn't use whatever information might be at its disposal, but that system is just not clearly, at least, influenced by what you think you should see or what you hope to see. And I think it's worth pointing out that this is an especially strong debate because early on in the 50s, right, the psychologist Jerome Yeah. Bruner actually proposed the very opposite of what we're claiming. In a series of studies that became very well known, he actually had children estimate the size of a coin. And what he showed was that poor children perceive coins as larger than rich children, and that something about the poorer children's desire for the money or, you know, hope that they could have the money, it loomed large, very sort of literally loomed large.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, this is where the controversy really got going.
Yeah. And in some way, it speaks to very broad debates over like realism and relativism. We know we don't see the world as it really is in some sense. We just talked about that. But on the other hand, you know, an extreme relativist would say, oh, we just see the world as we want to see it. And right. everything is contaminated by our beliefs. And the realist, and I think you and I are realists to that extent, hold the line at some point.
Yeah.
Just wishful thinking doesn't make it so. Just assumptions don't make it so.
It's hard for me, at least, to reconcile the success that we have as a species, or, you know, as organisms in general, who can navigate the physical environment without believing that somehow there isn't a robust, reliable system that is not going to be left to the whims of our desires and our wishes.
That's right. And there's a real subtlety in it, which is, you know, you're sipping wine. And to some extent, the taste of the wine will be influenced by your expectations about what you're sipping. There was a classic study which gave people in a glass which was not transparent. They gave people wine. They told them it was red versus white, and people would taste it differently depending on what they thought it was. On the other hand, if you poured motor oil in there, you know, people say we really do have the experience of thinking, I thought this was going to be delicious, and it's not. You know, I opened a door and I thought it was going to be my friend, but it's my grandma. Life would be very different if believing your friend was showing up means that whoever you see in front of you're going to see them as your friend. Life would be a disaster.
Right. The debate has levels.
That's right.
We don't have the time and space or probably expertise to cover exactly what kind of information makes it in. But the view that it's willy-nilly,
yeah,
that we all see what we want to see, seems to, I think, you and me, to be a sort of preposterous view of what our sensory systems are doing. You know, and by and large, we have the same equipment working to allow us to see, hear, smell, and taste things. So there might be differences, but it should be no surprise that we all share a sensory world. And then it should be no surprise that they are referencing something truly outside
That's
of
right.
our heads.
That's yeah. right. And there's something else that the study of vision, even early on, showed us, which is how hard it is. So this is one of the ways in which I'm kind of a big fan of computer science and AI, because there were a lot of early attempts to build machines that could see. They could see as well as a two-year-old navigating through, can identify objects, can find objects in space, and so on. And in the 60s, people thought, this is going to be easy. This cannot not be such a difficult problem.
We're almost there.
Right now we're living in the self-driving cars almost there world too, and part of the problem is you can't yet build a self-driving car that could see as well as your average, you know, 16-year-old just got her driver's license driver. It suggests it's an extremely difficult computational task to go from these things that fall upon our retina, basically patterns of light which you could turn into patterns of number, and from that extract a 3D world, and the computations, the sort of post-production system that needs to work, is so complex that after I don't know how much money and how much time, we're slowly coming to machines that could recognize static pictures of objects at a pretty good rate.
Yeah, and we have to throw a whole bunch of computational power and a whole bunch of data at these systems. And it's not as if we haven't made huge strides. I mean, the accuracy numbers grow and grow and grow. It's just that clearly our success with computational models of perception doesn't seem to be due to the fact that we're mimicking the human computational system of perception.
No, that's right.
And you can tell, but really by the errors that are made. Even if those errors are shrinking, the errors are ridiculous.
The errors are ridiculous. The fact that these machines make errors is itself not a problem. Three-year-olds make errors, but they make the sort of errors that people don't tend to make, and suggesting to do things in a very different way. I'm sure this is going to be popular once AI is used more in the real world. But you know, if you have a T-shirt and you put on a T-shirt a painting of a picture of a school bus, you can make a self-driving car think you're a school bus, and that's actually not such a good thing. The way these things could be deceived, it's because they do it in a very different way. I mean, very roughly, the deep learning algorithms learn to recognize school buses by looking at a million pictures of school buses and a million pictures of things that are not school buses, getting reinforced for a school bus answer for the right ones, not the wrong ones. But that's not how, you know, a 3 year or a 2 year old who points and says bus, that's not how the 2 year old does it.
Right. I'm now wondering if Wile E. Coyote could fool a Tesla by painting a road on a brick wall.
I enjoy the references that people only above, you know, 40 will understand.
Paul, should we move on to talk about memory? I want to talk a little bit about the importance of memory in identity and who we are. Sure, memory, like perception, is great for increasing the survival of the organism. If I know where that predator was, for instance, and I know the next time to avoid that location, I'm more likely to survive. But as human beings, every day we're storing these rich memories. And when we ponder why we are who we are or what makes us what we are, it's hard to avoid the claim that, well, we are a collection of all of these instances that we've lived before that have lived on in memory. And I find it sometimes existentially distressing when somebody remembers something that I don't about what happened in my own life. Or when I remember something that nobody else seems to remember. It's a little distressing because I don't want to doubt this thing that I hold dear.
You know, philosophers have long, I think John Locke particularly long, associated memory with identity. The idea being that if I woke up with your memories and you woke up with mine, to some in some interesting way, I would be you and you would be me. What holds me together. Right. When I wake up in the morning, what makes me me, the same guy who went to bed last night, was I share the memories. And I don't quite get that in a sense that I could imagine total amnesia. Now, we got to be careful what we're talking about. There's a lot of memories. Like I know how to walk and how to talk and how to use English and everything. The amnesia we're talking about, the memories we're talking about, are sort of autobiographical personal memories. And that's what gets connected to identity. I sort of think that if I had a total loss of memory, there's a sense in which I'd still be me.
I feel the same way. You know the case of Clive Wearing. So I show this video to my class sometimes. Clive Wearing is somebody who famously has retrograde amnesia, that he has forgotten large portions of his autobiographical story. But he also has anterograde amnesia. He cannot form new memories, and he has been unable to do so for the longest time. So he has a memory span of a minute. Which is one of the most severe cases that we know of. He does recognize and remember his wife, but he has absolutely no memory of really who he is. So large parts of his memory are just gone, and he cannot form new memories. And I would venture to say that he is still Clive Wearing. He is identity in some deep sense is preserved, even though it's not as rich as it would be otherwise. He knows who he is in some deep sense.
So these aren't literally one in a million cases. There are some things in psychology which are very, very rare. This isn't that rare. There are a lot of people who have this sort of damage due to, for instance, severe alcoholism and Korsakoff syndrome. And they can't create, they can't form new long-term memories. So it's not a problem of short-term memory. They could hold things in their head. Like if I go to one of these people and say, remember the following four numbers, they could say, you know, I got it. I'm holding it onto my head. But nothing sticks. Nothing ends up in the sort of long-term, the library we have in our heads. So there's these famous cases I talk about, like HM. Very famous case who taught us a lot about memory, who would work with the same psychologists for years and years and years and years. And every time they come in, he would politely, very polite man, he would politely introduce himself to these people. And it, oh, entirely anew. The fictionalized treatments of this, there is a not particularly bad Adam Sandler movie called 50 First Dates. and there's a wonderful, one of my favorite movies ever by Christopher Nolan, Memento, which tells the story of somebody with damage so they cannot create new memories.
And there, one of my pet peeves is they refer to it as short-term memory damage. But as you say, yes, it's short-term memory is actually intact. It's just that short-term memory is we can only hold for a few minutes, you know, 10 minutes maybe. And then if we want to keep it, it has to shuffle on into the long-term.
That's right. So if you think about how much we have in long-term memory, people have tried to quantify it in terms of gigabytes, and it's hard to make sense. But every person you met, everything you could remember, which is enormous, staggering, everything you could kind of replay in your head and imagine form, that's your long-term memory. Your short-term memory is pretty, pretty limited. You know, you could think about all the numbers you know, everybody's phone number and you know, all of that. And now think about how many numbers you could hold in your head right now. And the answer is not that many, maybe like 7.
There's another kind of memory that's even more fickle and shorter. I don't remember if you talk about it in your book, but sensory memory.
That's right. I do.
That is the fleetingest of your brain sort of recognizing that something has happened. You can imagine when I'm teaching class, I always tell people, you know, someone just coughed a second ago and it went into your brain and it just never got into your short-term memory.
So we got to pursue that because it gets next to the question of the limits of memory and what people get wrong about memory. I just got to say two things about sensory memory, which I find cool. One is that if you write your name with sparklers, like, and you see streaks of light, the streaks of light are your sensory visual memory. They don't really exist in space. They exist in your brain. They're after images of memory. And then the second thing is auditory. Sensory visual memory is very short, I think less than a second, but auditory memory is a little bit longer. And you can have the experience of somebody saying something to you, but you're not really listening because you're looking at your phone. And they say, "What did I say?" And sometimes, if the timing is right, it's just there. So you told me, you know, we got to do laundry. And then they stare at you because they also know about sensory memory.
That's right. So long-term memory, though, you talk about some estimates to calculate it, but it is effectively limitless. That is, to my knowledge, there's nobody who has received a memory full error in their brain. Of course, it's finite because our brains are finite.
I saw in one of the Sherlock Holmes series, Sherlock Holmes explains to Watson that he refuses to learn useless facts because he doesn't want to clutter up his memory. He wants to leave it free for more important things. But that is not really how it works.
That's not how it works. There are all kinds of examples of people who, for one reason or another, in some cases, the people we call savants who are capable of memorizing entire books word for word. There are people with stunningly accurate autobiographical memories who remember every detail of every day they've ever lived since memory kicked in.
Yeah.
It's never been the case that as far as I know, that somebody just was incapable of holding in any more information, a la Sherlock's claim.
That's right. So something you said before regarding attention and how stuff that gets into short-term memory, this large but finite store, depends on what you're attending to, among other things, gets us to one of the limitations, which is if you don't attend to it, it doesn't get in. It happened to you. It happened in your brain. You heard the cough. You stored it for a second. or less than a second, and then you didn't attend, and it's just gone, and it's gone. It's gone forever.
Yeah. This is, I think, one of the worst abuses of popular treatments of memory. The idea that if you were at all around in the environment, that somehow it got encoded. So to use another reference that dates me completely, there was an episode of a sitcom when I was growing up called Different Strokes.
Oh, yeah.
Where Arnold had witnessed a crime, witness, quote unquote, but he couldn't remember the license plate of the car. And so they had a hypnotist come and yes. hypnotize him until he could perfectly visualize what the license plate of the car was. And they were able to nab the perpetrator because of that. But the truth is, if he never looked at that license plate and got it into even short-term memory, attended to it, there is no chance that he could retrieve that memory.
It's a memory analog. I'm sure you know the name of this, but there's some sort of fallacy where you see in all these spy movies where they have a little picture of something and they, you know, they take a little picture and says, well, hey, let's zoom in. And then they keep zooming
yeah,
in.
Yeah, right.
And with tremendous clarity.
Enhance.
That's right. That's right. And I give the example from Michael Connelly, who's a crime writer I adore. He wrote the Hieronymus Bosch series, which is also a TV series.
Oh, yeah.
But it's exactly the same thing. It's someone is being interviewed and say, okay, this is like 6 months ago. Okay. So, okay, now you're seeing it on a TV screen. So stop, you know, zoom in, luminous license plate. What do you see? And it's not how memory works.
No.
Memory is, it's not merely that memory is limited. It's that memory is, to some extent, a reconstruction.
Reconstruction is the best word for it, because I think when you understand that memory is not in the business of keeping perfect records, that it's only then that you can kind of understand why it has the particular quirks that it does. This episode of Psych is sponsored by GiveWell. When you give to charity, how much impact will your donation actually have? This question can be hard, if not impossible, to answer. Most charities just can't tell you how your money will be used or how much good it'll accomplish. You may know it could theoretically help a cause, but how? Or more importantly, how much? If you want to help people living in poverty with evidence-backed, high-impact charities, we recommend you check out GiveWell. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funds to a few of the highest impact evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and will improve the lives of millions more. Using GiveWell's research is absolutely free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There's no need to sign up, no need to give any personal information. They want you to have it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Make sure that they know you heard about GiveWell from Psych to get your donation matched. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych. Maybe we don't remember everything, but surely there are times when things that happen to us that are so vivid, so detailed, we have perfect memory for those, you might say.
In the business, they're called flashbulb memories.
Yeah. So for I don't know, how old were you? You're too young for JFK.
I am too young for JFK, but I do remember 9/11. I'm sure some people listening to us do not remember 9/11, and
right. They
have to. What would that be when, I don't know, when Elon Musk bought Twitter?
Or when Taylor Swift tickets sold out.
That's right. When Ticketmaster went down. That's so when this September 11 attacks happened, I actually was at Yale, and a team of memory psychologists immediately took down reports from people as to what happened so they could test them later.
Yeah.
in their memories.
I was also at Yale. You probably don't remember.
You were also at Yale. That's right. So I did not remember that. So my reconstruction didn't have you in there.
I give an anecdote in my class that will tell a little bit about the history of this concept of flashbulb memory and how it was shown to be misleading. So the term flashbulb memory was coined by a couple of researchers in the 70s, Brown and Kulik. And it wasn't really until somebody used the paradigm that you just referred to, that of like what I like to call ambulance chasing psychology.
Yeah.
that it was really studied, because up until that point, what we knew about these kinds of memories is that people reported for these very vivid, highly important, often shared incidents like the JFK assassination, that people reported that they had a clear memory. It was vivid. It was, they could tell you where they were when it happened, how they heard that it happened, and what happened right after they heard. And if that's the only data that you had, it would seem, wow, there really are some instances that are seared in memory. And there's a great William James quote about this, where the metaphor that he had was that it really sort of burned itself into your cerebral tissue. Hmm.
Very William James.
Yeah. And it wasn't until the cognitive psychologist Ulrich Neisser here at Cornell did a little bit of ambulance chasing on his own that we learned a bit more about what was going on. So in 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger, famously a mission that included for the first time a non-astronaut. It was a school teacher who had been selected to be part of this space shuttle crew. Everybody was watching. I was a kid in 86. I would have been 10 years old, 11 years old.
I was in graduate school at MIT. I saw it
saw it live.
Watching TV in a public space.
Right. Yeah. The space shuttle blew up. Spoiler. The space shuttle blew up in front of everybody's, you know, people had dragged TVs into classrooms just to let the kids watch this. This was a time when NASA was very exciting. Of course, it was a devastating moment. Neisser and colleagues actually went to schools right afterwards and asked students where they were, how they heard about it, who they heard it from, and what happened right after. And then they came back a couple of years later, I don't remember exactly how long, and they asked them again. And a kid's confidence in all of their memories was just as strong. They reported how vivid it was. They reported where they were when they heard and what happened afterwards. But turned out that their accuracy was actually very low. These very vivid flashbulb memories weren't like flashbulbs at all. They had completely changed. Information that happened after the fact worked its way in. They were reconstructed memories that were no more accurate than any other kind of autobiographical memory. And this is my story, Paul. When I would tell this I used to teach a class on emotions, I always told my class exactly where I was. I said I was in sixth grade and I was not allowed to watch it live because I had a teacher in sixth grade whom I hated, did not like the guy. He got me in trouble all the time. And so because of that, I was not watching it live. It was only years after teaching, so I must have taught it 4 or 5 years, that I was looking at the date and I realized I was completely wrong. I was an entire year off. I thought I was in sixth grade and that this teacher whom I hated had prevented us from watching it. I was in fifth grade in January of 1986, and it was a completely different teacher, and I didn't see it, but for completely different reasons. And here's what happened, I think. I didn't like this teacher, and I had a story about a teacher not letting us watch it. So my dislike for this teacher in sixth grade worked its way in and completely changed my memory of the events. I had just put dislikable teacher in there, and it had shaped my memory in a way that was now embarrassingly inaccurate.
That's a perfect example of how memory works. Every part of it, the confidence you had you know, it's how human memory is different from a computer, where in a computer, you know, I look up an old file, looking it up doesn't change the contents.
Right.
But when we talk about something which happened, or when we answer questions about it, it does change the contents. So I remember where I was 9/11. I remember where I was during a lot of things. But if it's significant enough, I told people about it. And I bet what I remember is my story I told.
Yeah. You know, when I was in, let's see, what year it was, I was in college. I was home in Southern California over the break, and I was on the freeway with a friend of mine, and a white car sped right past us, followed by a bunch of police officers.
You're not going to tell me this was the O.J. Simpson thing.
Paul, I was on the freeway when O.J. Simpson was escaping in the Bronco. I had forgotten about it until my friend reminded me, my friend who was driving reminded me years later. And yeah. I said, really? Were we? Because of course, at the time, I didn't know what was going on. So I had to like be told after we were off the freeway that this was the famous Bronco chase. Now I feel like I have a memory of it. And I have to admit to myself, I don't think that memory is from the happening of it, but rather the memory from being told of it. Just like the Piaget story that you mentioned in your book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are so many stories like this. And I think we're going to talk about the evidence for it, the psychological research on it. But I think it should give us more sympathy for people. I remember a while ago, Hillary Clinton told a story of how she was, I forget what country she was in, but she was under fire as in a role as Secretary of State. And then footage came out, and that was didn't what happened at all. It was actually pretty safe. Right. And people were saying, what a horrible liar. What a sinister, or maybe she's insane. But it was years ago. We our memory, that is the rule, not the exception, in that if somebody tells me a story of what happened years ago and it has any detail at all, I immediately say, assume none of this is really true as they're telling it. You know, okay, maybe they did go to that country, maybe something did happen, and then I told him and then he told me, and it's not, we don't recover things like that. These are sort of reconstructions. And what's harder to do is to do it for myself. Like, you know, and if you've ever had the experience of having an argument with somebody saying, you know, you said, you know, you know, a couple of months ago, you really treated me very badly when you did this and this. And this. No, I didn't. You got everything totally wrong. And it's extremely infuriating. And the odds are you're both horribly wrong.
You know, Ted Chiang has a wonderful story about this sci-fi author, Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling, where he describes a sort of near future time where technology is developed that can record every single event that happens to us. And the story centers around an argument that was had, a fight that was had, that led to an estrangement between father and daughter. And the way that it turns out is actually a spectacular little bit of psychology that Chiang incorporates into this. And I think likely inspired by some of the work that we're going to talk about now, which is that one of the problems with this model of memory as being 100% accurate and retrievable is that it's gotten people into some really, really bad situations.
So we're giving anecdote after anecdote, but you actually worked with Elizabeth Loftus, who's done some of the pivotal work on this.
That's right. As a postdoc at UC Irvine, I had the opportunity to work with her. And this was at a time where it was very exciting because she had just done some of the studies and just published some of the studies that you refer to in the book, in particular, a set of studies showing that you can make people believe that events happened to them in their childhood that didn't actually happen to them. I should say, to be more precise, make people remember events happening to them, not just believe them, if you just give them the right kind of false information. So a famous study is this Lost in the Mall study where she told people that she had spoken with their parents to get some anecdotes about their childhood, and they told them about this time they were lost in the mall. And she brought participants in a few weeks later, And sure enough, they had a memory of being lost in the mall. Of course, she was able to verify that for most of those people, they had never actually been lost in a mall. But nonetheless, they didn't just believe it. It's not just that, well, she must have talked to my parents, yeah. and so therefore it must be true. It was that they had started to form memories. And memories are different from just mere beliefs. We have sensory information attached to it. We have, you know, subjective perspective, autobiographical details that we infuse that are part of those memories. And that's what was starting to happen. They were growing like little parasites.
It's true. I mean, it's we have to be careful that it's never 100% of people who do this. Sometimes it's less than 50%. Some people are more susceptible than others. On the other hand, these are often really fairly mild inductions to get people to agree with it. Remember it, falsely remember it. This has tremendous consequences for the legal system, because there's a natural tendency when an eyewitness says, oh, that happened and I remember it and I'm 100% confident of it, to take them at their word. And it's worth knowing for ourselves and for other people that that isn't necessarily the case. One thing which is genuinely frightening is there have been cases where people have been interrogated extensively over long periods of time with no sleep and so on about crimes that they are believed to have been committed. And in at least some cases, people have come to remember committing the crime, even if it turns out later, it's pretty clear that they hadn't done it.
It's incredible. And I think this is one, you know, if ever anybody asks what real impact has psychology had in the world, I think this is one of the greatest examples. That work on false confessions, the work on eyewitness identification. Eyewitness identification had long been held as the gold standard for putting someone away. You know, now we have other kinds of evidence that are more reliable, like DNA evidence, forensic evidence like that. But eyewitness testimony has always had this special place in the legal system. And it wasn't really until people like Elizabeth Loftus came along and showed not just that it was possible, but that it was not that difficult to get people to remember things that didn't happen. So one of the ways, it's very consistent with what we've been saying, is by asking leading questions. If I say, what did the gun look like that was in the perpetrator's hand, Paul? And you might say, he didn't have a gun. But a week later, you might start remembering, actually, I think there might have been a gun.
That's right. It could sometimes be very subtle. This may be not be exactly right, but it was a study of the form where they said, how fast was the bus moving when it bumped into the tree or whatever versus when it smashed into the tree? And then a week later, in the smash case, you assume it was going faster. You remember it as faster.
That was the sort of first paper that Loftus published showing this, of course, very influential paper, where she manipulated essentially the verbs and crashed, impacted, hit, collided, yeah. and had people estimate the speeds, remember the speeds that they saw in a video that she showed them. She told me that the only reason that she started doing those studies was that as a junior professor, she knew that she needed grant money. And she was looking for sources of grant money as a cognitive psychologist who was interested in memory. And it turns out that there was a source of funding that was possible from the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration, is that what it's called? And she thought to herself, how can I make my basic research have anything to do with cars and transportation?
Yeah.
And because of that, she ran those now, you know, seminal studies.
So many psychology stories. Like, but why did you study fruit? People's memory of fruit. Well, the Fruit Foundation was giving away a lot of money.
Right. It's either that or I got in a huge argument with my significant other about the fruit and I needed to run some studies that I was right.
There's also the sort of shtick about research being research where basically if you find out what people study, you find out either the greatest strengths or the greatest weakness. And we both study moral psychology.
Let's not bring that up.
Yeah. But this is, you know, it's important. It has real social consequences. On the one hand, you know, you don't want to reflexively doubt people's testimony of terrible crimes and committed against them, particularly even in cases where the crimes have no other witnesses. On the other hand, there's been enough cases where, say, DNA evidence have exonerated people who were identified with 100% confidence by the victim. And we can, I think, work to make assessments of memory better. There's a lot more protocols for identifying witnesses, identifying suspects that are less biased, that don't push them into things.
And, you know, we haven't even talked about perhaps the most controversial case of false memories of abuse as children. In the 80s and 90s, there was this big wave of adults who had gone to therapy and had undergone a particular kind of therapy that was intended to recover their memories as a child.
Yeah.
Now, this is a very Freudian idea, as we discussed. Like, Freud believed that a memory could be so painful that you actively repressed it, and it just, even though you had memory of it, you just put it away. And Elizabeth Loftus was involved in doing some research, trying to figure out what was going on here. And it turned out that a lot of therapists were using techniques that, almost as if they had done the studies themselves to show how you could manipulate somebody's memory, they were bringing people in and guiding their thoughts and implanting ideas such that after session, the patient started recovering memories that their parents had abused them. Often this was satanic ritual abuse. You said, Paul, earlier that it's kind of difficult to tell somebody that they are wrong about a traumatic event that happened to them. In this case, in these kinds of cases, especially so. These were people who genuinely seemed to believe that their parents had abused them. But oftentimes, parents who were themselves completely shocked that anything like that would ever be an accusation leveled against them with no evidence whatsoever. And Elizabeth Loftus, I think, played a key role in trying to show that these recovered memory techniques were themselves a source of abuse.
Yeah, there was a sort of, as it got called, as the satanic panic, where for a period, I think in California largely, there were people from daycares and from schools were arrested, were charged, based on these Florida reports of satanic cults eating babies and mass graves and everything, ultimately with no evidence at the end. It was largely later on understood to be a weird, just this weird thing built on bizarre techniques that were basically memory implantation techniques. And there's more to be said about why the whole community seemed to believe in this. We're going to talk about clinical psychology later, and I think we're both pretty positive about therapy. I'll go on to recommend that if you have a psychological problem, you should see a therapist. There's a lot of evidence it works. However, there are some unusual cases where therapy has caused adverse events, and you just pointed out one of them. And a second one, which we will discuss, is the issue of multiple personality disorder. And where in very, very similar ways, over-enthusiastic, I think well-intentioned therapists have basically caused their patients to have a problem they didn't walk in with.
Is there anything we're forgetting, Paul?
Oh, I see that. No, I'm quite confident we've remembered all of the material with crystal clear accuracy.
We walked through our memory palaces.
That's right. Oh. Do you want to end by telling people what a memory palace is?
One of the questions that anybody who studies memory will always get is, how can I improve my memory? And there are wonderful techniques that can improve your memory. And in fact, it seems as if memory is just one of those things we don't practice that much because, you know, in the computer age, we have so much information available to us. But even just the invention of writing and books means that we don't have to remember large pieces of information that used to be handed down orally. But there are traditions that are very old that were meant to aid in memory storage and recall. And one of these was called the memory palace. It was a method that I think, you know, before there was a science of psychology, that made use of some tricks that we now know are very reliable. And one of them is that our spatial memory is incredibly good. So if you want to remember something, it helps to create in your mind a geographical location. Maybe it helps if I tell a concrete example. David Smith is my colleague here who studies memory. He studies it in rats, but he's an expert on the hippocampus, that area that seems especially dedicated to memory. During a summer course that he teaches for adults, for alumni, these are usually people in their 70s or 80s who already believe that their memory is failing. He takes them on a little walk, and he takes them on a walk through Cornell's campus. And as he walks them through Cornell's campus, he gives them a word at particular little markers that he has set up. So when they get to this memorial bench, he says, remember the word juxtapose. When they get to a particular statue, he says, remember the word alchemy. When they get to the end of that trail, remember another word, and so on. Then he has them remember a list, quite a long list of words. In other words, a list that would be difficult if you were just given that list. At the end of the week of class, he has them walk that trail once again, and he simply asks them, try to remember each word that you learned on this trail. And they were very skeptical that this would work. But the way that they describe phenomenologically, like what they experience when they walk the trail, is when they hit that bench, when they get there, they said the word, it is as if the image of the word just popped into their head, the word juxtapose at the bench, the word alchemy at the statue. And so what he was teaching them was basically the memory system is very good at spatial orientation. So if you can leverage that, you can do a really, really good job of remembering large pieces of information. Combine that with, Paul, something you say in your book about the memory champion that came and talked to your class.
I'll tell that story. So I got Joshua Foer, who was a writer of some repute, and then he decided to explore memory, and he ended up becoming the United States memory champion. One of the feats he can do is memorize a whole deck of cards. The 52 cards, just looking at it, second each card, boom, 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 and then he remembers it all. And a trick, he uses, actually, in some way it is a memory palace. What he does to add to it is each of the cards is associated with some often, you know, graphic and striking image, you know, famous celebrities doing disgusting things. And he puts it together and when he gets to 52 cards, he basically puts it together into an extremely vivid, disgusting, but ultimately very memorable story. But I got to say, and he gave me permission to tell the story in my book, I had him come to Yale to my intro psych course to talk to the whole class about memory, techniques, how to remember things. But as a nice illustration of how different forms of memory are different and intentional memory is different from accidental memory, he emailed me after leaving the class a few hours later to say he left his cell phone there.
Right. I have not read his book, but I've seen his TED talk.
It's wonderful.
It is great. And yeah, he combines this vivid, you know, there's a lot of research showing that emotions can be very helpful for remembering things. So combining those vivid images with those cards and walking through a remembered or imagined geographical setup, he's able to sort of take himself on the journey and repeat all 52 cards, which is an incredible, incredible feat, considering that they are these memory champions who all, by the way, use the same exact technique to remember these things, that they can memorize entire decks in minutes. I mean, with single digit minutes. It's incredible.
And they are all at pains to say they don't have any particular natural gifts. They just learned the techniques and use them. And I think there we're sort of seeing, you know, there's different forms of memory. There's intentional memorizing something, which is what we're talking about now. And that can be done really well if you use the proper techniques. Then there's the everyday life that you don't intentionally remember, you just live it. And unfortunately, for better or worse, often worse, when we think back on that, it's reconstructive in exactly the ways we're talking about, and so really imperfect.
Memory fails for all sorts of reasons. So unless you want to go around creating very vivid images for where you left your keys, chances are you're just going to continue to lose your keys.
Yes. That's the story of my life.
I think we've done justice to memory.
Memory, vision, perception, sensation.
Wow, we covered a large chunk of the mind there, Paul.
Yeah. We still have a lot to go.
We still have a lot to go.
Thank you.